The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to the Space Show on Monday, and I am your host, David Livingston. Thanks for tuning in. I'm going to rush through our announcements. I want to spend as much time as possible talking to our guest today, to Eric Lerner. For those of you that can give us a call and you would like to talk to Eric, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. There are no call screeners, so be patient. We will answer the phone and get you up on air as quickly as possible. You can also send us email at drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com, or you can post a comment on our blog for this show, which is at thespaceshow.com. Then go over to the right for upcoming shows. This is the first program listed. Open up that archive page, and comments, as always, are down at the bottom. And have at it. You can post as a guest, or if you want to log into a Discuss account, you can do that as well. And I will get your comment or question for Eric almost immediately and can work it into the program. So those are the three ways that you can communicate with us today. Of course, our toll-free number is always preferable, 866-687-7223. The rest of the website, thespaceshow.com, do check it out. Our full weekly newsletter is there on the website. This is a detailed version, so you can see the details of what's planned this week, plus the upcoming schedule for the next couple of months, because it's filled out now coming into the second quarter of 2017. Everything we do is archived. Don't forget you can listen right off of the website or easily download the short shows. Check out our store under the support menu in the upper left corner. And then, of course, to me, the most important button is the Support the Space Show. We are a 501c3 nonprofit, so we do need your support to keep the Space Show going. We are very appreciative of those of you that do support us. If you are a U.S. federal taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. The same is true for those of you paying California taxes. Check out our 501c3 sponsor and parent, OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. And if you have any questions, do get a hold of us. And again, we deeply appreciate those of you who do support us and those of you who will be supporting us in the very near future. We do have sponsors for the program, so let me just call your attention to their ads that go across the homepage. Do read them from time to time. And for the first segment of today's show, we have a couple of sponsors that we're talking about. One is the Space Foundation, and they have their upcoming 33rd Space Symposium, which is a must-attend industry event. It is August 3rd through the 6th in Colorado Springs, Colorado. All of the details for the event and making reservations are at spacesymposium.org. And in addition to that, Orbital ATK is a sponsor. They're known as a global leader in aerospace and defense technology and the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. So check out their banner ad and their website, and we appreciate these sponsors and the others that I will thank during the second segment of today's program. So I'm very happy to welcome back to the Space Show Eric Lerner. And Eric is the president and chief scientist and has been active in dense plasma-focused DPF research for the past 30 years. Beginning in 1984, he developed a detailed quantitative theory of the functioning DPF. I could read about him, but I don't want to. I want to talk to him because it's much more valuable to talk to him. And those of you who listen to the Space Show all the time know Eric because he's been coming on the program and helping us understand fusion and updating us with his work for many, many years now. His full bio is on our website, and I urge you to read it. Let's talk to Eric and welcome you back to the program. How are you? Happy New Year to you, and it's good to talk to you again.
Okay, well, Happy New Year to you, and thanks for having me back.
So we were checking just before the show. You were last on a year ago in March of 2016. Are we closer? What's happening and what has happened in the past year?
Yeah, I think we've made some definite progress. What is going on with the device is that right now we are testing this device with tungsten electrode. And the reason we're using tungsten electrode is that this device concentrates electric currents enormously. And it produces magnetic fields that are able to compress the fusion fuel and heat it to fusion temperatures. So what we're doing with the tungsten is trying to reduce to a minimum the impurities that we get in when these high current vaporize material off of our electrode. Tungsten is a very heat-resistant material. The problem we ran into starting in 2015 was that tungsten oxidizes easily. And tungsten oxide, which is a compound that's formed, is not resistant to heat at all. In fact, it breaks up very easily at about 500°C. So when we last talked, we were basically looking for ways to reduce the oxide. And we partially succeeded last year. What we did was we were able to bake the vacuum chamber out, elevate it to a higher temperature, not very high. And that got rid of most of the water vapor, which, of course, was a source of oxygen, H2O. So then we ran the machine, and we were able to reduce the impurity, not as much as we wanted, but substantially by about a factor of 50%. And what we found was that, indeed, the fusion yield increased to a new record for our machine, which was about 50% above our last record. And the temperature that we achieved, which was already very high, that increased by about 50% as well. And when I'm talking about very high temperature, the temperature we reached was the equivalent of about 2.5 billion degrees Kelvin. So that's something of the order of more than 200 times the temperature at the center of the sun. So that was good progress, but we were concerned that we hadn't succeeded in totally eliminating the oxide. So what we've done since then is that we replaced our tungsten anode. That's the positive electrode, which is a cylinder at the center of the device, with a fresh anode, also made out of tungsten, which was a little shorter. And in addition to the baking out, we used a technique that other people have pioneered, which is microwaving it. And this is actually, it's really quite simple. What you do is you attach a microwave generator, just from an ordinary microwave oven, to a window of the vacuum chamber. And when I'm talking about the vacuum chamber, I'm talking about an object pretty small. This is about a foot across and 2 feet long, cylinder. We flow hydrogen gas at relatively low pressure through this vacuum chamber. And when the microwaves hit this gas, they're absorbed by the hydrogen molecule. Nitrogen molecules get so hot, thousands of degrees in this case, that they break up into individual hydrogen atoms. So the normal hydrogen molecule has two hydrogen atoms in it. Now, hydrogen atoms are very chemically active. They really want to combine with other substances. So what happens is the hydrogen atoms pull the oxygen off the tungsten oxide. So they, in chemical terms, they reduce the tungsten oxide to pure metallic tungsten. And then, since we're continuously pumping that out, that becomes water vapor, H2O, which we pump out. So that's what we're trying right now. So let me stop there, and before I say how we're doing, why don't you just see whether you need to ask any clarifying questions.
How do you contain and work with these really high temperatures?
Well, when we're talking about the microwaving, we don't really have to take any precautions, because at thousands of degrees, this gas is still sufficiently diffuse that it has very little energy. So even though the gas is 1,000 degrees, it only heats up our big middle chamber by a few degrees C. Now, in terms of the billions of degrees that we generate when the machine fires, that's contained by the tremendously powerful magnetic field that the current itself produces. And that's through an effect called the pinch effect. So the pinch effect occurs whenever you have currents, electric currents running in the same direction. They create a magnetic field that attracts those currents together. And this was discovered many years ago, actually, by Michael Faraday. So, Ampere. And Michael Faraday actually studied this effect as well. So this device takes million ampere currents that only operate for microseconds, millions of seconds, and it concentrates it at the end of these electrodes. So these currents essentially tie themselves up into a little knot that we call a plasmid. And within the knot, these extremely high magnetic fields caused by concentrating current in a very small area, that's what confines these billion-degree plasmas. So they're kept far away from the material part. The thing that we do have to worry about is where the currents themselves touch the electrode. We have to worry about the electrodes heating up and therefore vaporizing and getting material into the plasma. That we don't want to happen, because these heavy metals prevent the high densities that we need. So that's what we're doing right now, is we're trying to minimize that vaporization of these metals. First of all, by getting rid of the oxide.
So down the road, when you are able to have a commercial unit, you're sustaining these reactions indefinitely rather than just for millions of a second, right?
No. It would be a pulsed power generator.
Okay.
In other words, even a generator would act. We have familiar examples of pulsed power generators, which is our automobile. An automobile engine is a pulse power device, because what happens is about 200 times a second, your spark plug will fire. That generates a pulse of power that's conveyed to the piston. Now, the way an engine is designed is that the pistons and the mechanical parts smooth out that power to generate a smooth average power delivered to the drivetrain. Similarly, our device, if we get it to the point where it's a generator, would be firing about as rapidly as your car, about 200 times a second. Each time, it would be producing power only for a very short amount of time. Actually, would produce power for tens of nanoseconds, tens of billions of a second. That power would be absorbed by a capacitor, and then your electric circuitry would smooth that power out so that it could be fed back into the grid in a continuous manner. But we're still aiming basically to only produce this power for a very short amount of time, each shot. To get back to where we are, we did succeed in eliminating, we think, the oxygen with this microwave treatment. When we put the machine together again last month in January. But as in all research projects, there are little surprises. And when we started firing the machine, we found that, as we say, it burped. A vacuum chamber is sealed by gaskets that are kept under pressure by ordinary bolts. And unfortunately, when our machine fires, it vibrates. And what seems to have happened is that small amounts of gas that were trapped near these seals were released into the machine after it fired. And some of that gas was water vapor, and some of it was atmospheric oxygen. And therefore, we got the oxides back. So in the 3 weeks that we've been working with the machine, we're trying to optimize the microwave treatment so that we can treat it again and get those oxides back out before we go back to firing the machine. So where we are now is we've reduced the oxygen by another factor of 2, and to get where we want to go, we have about another factor of 5 to go. So we hope to get there in the next few weeks and then go back to firing and see whether we can't get a big boost in our fusion yield once we get rid of these impurities.
Why is there a 2-week timeline there?
Because we have to do a little experimentation with the microwaves themselves. We're monitoring the microwaves by looking at their glow in the optical. And we can see them through one of the other windows that we're using. And we've been able to observe that the distribution of the glowing gas within the chamber is very sensitive to where we put the magnetron. That's the device that produces microwaves. And its orientation and how much gas pressure we have. So we're fine-tuning that to get an even distribution of the hot gas. And that's important because if we don't have an even distribution, the oxygen is going to come off where the gas is hot and it's going to be deposited where the gas is cold. So what we want is to have the gas evenly hot wherever it's in contact with the electrode, and then the oxygen will just be pumped out. So we think that roughly speaking, it will take us a few weeks to do these experiments with microwaves and optimize it and then go back to firing.
You have an email question. It was from Jack in Houston. And he said, Eric, I'm really curious. Has this turned out to be a project that was much harder and taking much longer than you originally started when you started getting involved in this? And can you reasonably forecast a commercial operation timeline yet?
Well, the first question is easy. Oh, yeah, it took longer than we thought. I think everything in life takes longer than you thought. Part of the reason is we've never been adequately funded. I originally planned this project that we would start the project off with $2 million. In the bank, which is not a lot for a scientific project, especially one with this magnitude of results that we hope for. and that we would be able to hire enough people to run our small lab efficiently. Unfortunately, we've never achieved, although we have spent $5 million over a period of the past 9 years, we've never achieved $2 million in the bank at any time, or really the level of spending that we want to hire the people we want. So that's definitely held us up. Some of our holdup have been supplier delay. I'm going to be talking in a bit about the next stage of our research, which is we're going to be going from tungsten to beryllium electrode. And I'll explain why, but just in answer to this question, those beryllium electrodes, from the time we decided to get them and had the funding for them, which was summer of 2014, until their delivery, which we expect in a couple of weeks, that's almost 2 years. So some of the delays have had nothing to do with our research. Some have had to do with unexpected problems. And the biggest unexpected problem was this problem of impurities. If you look back to what I was saying before the project started, I wasn't really mentioning the problem of impurities. It really came up in the course of the research. So we've had to fight with that and figure out ways to overcome it. In terms of a timeline, I'm a little hesitant because I've been wrong before. But we do feel that once we get these beryllium electrodes, assuming we have adequate funding, and I'll talk a little bit about more about that in a minute, we would have about a year to prove scientific feasibility, by which we mean net energy out in the lab, more energy out of a laboratory device than we put into it. If we do that, then we think a development project to get us to a commercial product would take about 3 or 4 years, again, with adequate funding. And when I say adequate funding, I mean approximately $1 million or $1.5 million right now, and perhaps $50 to $100 million for an engineering project, which everybody knows are much more expensive than research projects.
That's a big jump in the funding.
That's right.
Interesting. Do you get
any... Engineering takes a lot more because you're really... You're jumping from a device that's firing once every 15 minutes to one that's going to be firing 200 times a second. And you have to worry about a lot of... reliability problems and maintenance problems and manufacturability problems. So you have to have many teams of engineers working on these various problems. Each of them will need their own device to play with. So the costs run up very quickly. So, but we're still thinking the device itself is very cheap to build. We're thinking that we could get that done for in the area of $50 to $100 million.
Do you qualify for, or is there any federal funding for your kind of research?
Well, our research actually started being funded by the federal government. This project started as a Jet Propulsion Lab project. We were aiming at fusion propulsion for space. And we had a very small amount of money, $300,000, which was spread over the period from 1994 to 2001. Unfortunately, NASA was sort of directed to get out of the fusion business with the new administration coming in 2001, and it's never got back in a big way. So at that point, we actually switched over to trying to raising the money privately. And that's what we've been doing. So it's not that we haven't asked the government periodically. We have asked the government periodically for money, but so far they've chosen to put it elsewhere. And I will say, by the way, we're going to be coming out very shortly, I think within the next month, with a video presentation comparing our efforts, and in fact comparing all the major efforts in fusion. And one of the comparisons we're going to do is how much money is being spent on these projects versus how much results they've got. And that comparison comes out very favorably for us, because if you divide the results we've gotten into the money we've spent, we would definitely be number one among all the fusion projects.
I've got a couple of emails, and I don't know if you want to address it yet, but they deal with fusion rocketry. Do you want to go down that road for a minute?
Sure.
Okay, so the first one I'll read to you comes from Bijan, who is in Sweden. And he says, what does it take to start a fusion rocket engine? Can it be throttled and restarted? And by the way, people keep sending me the name of this company, and I can't forget it or I would say it. And they claim they're building a fusion rocket. You probably know what I'm talking about. And they want me to put them on the show, but I've been reluctant to do that because I don't see how they can build a fusion rocket when they don't have any fusion energy yet. But
well, what's the name of the company? No,
I don't remember. And
You
know, I'm gonna, while you're talking here, I'm gonna search last year's email and see if I can find it. But they advertise on their website that they have a fusion rocket. So I am on
of
the opinion it's Looney Tunes, but I can't remember the name of it or I would say it. But in specific response to Bijan, what does it take to start a fusion rocket engine, and can you throttle it?
Well, the great advantage of our device, and by the way, we call this technology focused fusion. Focused fusion is our name for the combination of dense plasma-focused device with hydrogen-boron fuel. Hydrogen-boron fuel is important because it reduces its energy as charged particles, actually helium particles, helium nuclei, and essentially no neutrons. So focused fusion would be an ideal source of space propulsion, because part of the energy comes off naturally from this, device in the form of a focused ion beam. Now, for energy generation, we take all or as much as we can of the power of that beam and we feed it back for additional energy, for the net energy. In a propulsion unit, you would feed back part of that energy, but part of it you would allow to be the exhaust. So you could use that as an exhaust and get very high net velocity. In fact, theoretically, you could get to Mars in 2 weeks. The disadvantage of this approach is that each unit would be generating relatively low thrust. So you would actually have to need hundreds of these units banked together into a single engine. So in terms of throttling, yes, what you'd be doing is turning off some of these units to throttle the thrust to whatever level your flight plan demanded. So that's how it would work. What we see, if we can develop this as an energy source, what we see is the main additional engineering problem for space propulsion is that any generator generates a certain amount of waste heat. And that would be true of ours, too. On Earth, that waste heat is relatively easy to dispose of. But in space, you have to radiate it away. So the engineering problem would be to develop a very efficient light-based radiator to get rid of this excess heat. And then potentially you'd have an extremely high-performance, space propulsion device.
So is anyone, well, there is no fusion rocket that's close to reality, correct? I mean, it just doesn't exist, does it?
No, that doesn't mean people aren't working on it. I mean, I mentioned that NASA pretty much got out of this business in 01. They did stick a toe back in because I know they have one project in which they are funding a private company to work on a fusion design that's based on a device called the fusion mirror or the magnetic mirror. And they certainly aim at space propulsion. But, of course, as you say, the first step to getting to a fusion rocket is to get net energy from fusion on the ground, which undoubtedly is an easier task, getting fusion to also being a space propulsion device.
On the along the same line, Kelly sent in a question for you before the show started. And he says, this is the one I talked to you about before the show started, the focused fusion reactors obviously convert fuel to extremely high-speed stream of plasma. If you don't convert the kinetic energy of that stream to electricity, you have a fusion plasma rocket. Have you looked into the efficiency of this and its utility as a deep space propulsion system? Dr. Boussard calculated that his Polywell reactor could be adopted to allow, say, 6-month round trips to Saturn and establishment and operations of a base on Titan for an operating cost comparable to the current ISS station. I wonder how the Focus Fusion system could compare.
Right. I mean, it, as I said, this initial phases of this project, before we actually had an experimental device, when we were doing experiments in cooperation with universities, was funded by Jet Propulsion Lab for exactly this application. And when we were funded by JPL, we did very similar studies and got very similar results. We were using Mars as the comparison. And for Mars, you could get trip times down to about 2 weeks. And I'm sure for the outer planets, it would be, as Dr. Bissar calculated, a matter of a few months. The key point is that your exhaust velocity would be actually extremely high, probably even higher than would be optimal for zipping around the solar system. So absolutely, you could have extremely high efficiency. Now, whether you would actually want to establish a base on places like Jupiter or Saturn where the radiation environment is extremely challenging, hard to say. One possibility that people have talked about, including the Planetary Society, is to have missions in which human beings would be put into orbit, into space stations close to the target, such as in orbit around Mars or perhaps on a base on Phobos, and then they would be able to control extremely capable remote control devices in real time, which can't be done from Earth because of the delay in the radio signals reaching these planets. So in that way, you would be able to, A, protect yourself very heavily and very effectively against a high radiation environment, and perhaps equally important, you'd be able to protect the target of your research against contamination with all the trillions of microbes that we bring with us everywhere. So those kinds of missions are extremely difficult and extremely expensive to use in chemical rockets because chemical rockets have a very low exhaust velocity. and they become much more cheaper, much cheaper with any sort of successful fusion rocket. So definitely, we've done these studies. There's no question that fusion would be the ideal solution for this. And I could go further, which is, I mean, just considerably further in the future, possibly decades. But the energies that fusion releases do make it a candidate for even interstellar travel. You can calculate that a rocket that had a very high ratio of payload to fuel, in other words, a lot more fuel than payload, a fusion rocket could theoretically reach something like a third the speed of light. So then you could, you know, have reasonable expectation of at least having unmanned exploration of nearby stellar other stellar systems. And now, of course, we know that even our neighbor, Proxima Centauri, does have a planetary system. So we know that we have some places that might be of interest to go to.
Absolutely. So another one comes from Tim, who is in San Diego. And he said, Eric, if I recall from earlier space show programs, you're talking about a decentralized commercial system of being able to deliver electric power to consumers and users of today's grid, more so than you're talking about the fusion rocket. In calculating timelines and cost, do you have any way of calculating or considering the regulatory cost if there are hurdles to be able to do what you want to do with decentralized delivery of electrical power?
Well, we think that the regulatory hurdle should be very low. In other words, in the course of our development project, we want to, obviously, as I say, the scientific project has to demonstrate that this produces net energy. The engineering project has to demonstrate that it is reliable and can produce the energy, you know, over a continuing length of time. But in that development project, we're also going to demonstrate that it can produce the energy entirely safely. One of the great advantages of this approach is that there is no radioactive waste. Doesn't mean no radioactivity. Everything has radioactivity, including you and I. But radioactive waste is radioactive materials that are at a level dangerous to human life. This device would not produce any of that material. So we think that this device would actually be safer to locate in a distributed manner near to the load, such as that present-day distribution substation, and we hope to prove that, and we hope to politically motivate people to argue that the regulation should be at that level. In other words, we do not think that it would be at all appropriate to regulate this in the same way, for example, nuclear power plants are regulated, where clearly they are producing materials that are quite dangerous to human life. This is a completely different technology. So one of our educational tasks is educating people about the potential safety of this process, which would be much safer than existing sources of energy, such as fossil fuels or nuclear fission. And therefore, we think that the cost will be very low. We've estimated the cost based on, you know, preliminary engineering studies as being less than a few tenths of a cent per kilowatt hour. So that would be essentially a factor of 10 lower than the lowest price existing sources of energy, such as coal.
Carla sent you an email and says, David, I'm at work, so I'm not using the phone. But, Eric, millions, if not billions, have been put into large fusion research reactors around the world with the tokamaks and ITER, and I don't think they've ever even come close to any kind of break-even, be it engineering, scientific, or anything close to that. If they can't get to fusion break-even with all the money they've had, why do the smaller companies such as yours think that you can get to fusion the way you're going? You can't even get a fraction of the kind of money they've gotten over the years.
But we can get a very good fraction of the results we have. One of the things that the video is going to show that we're now finalizing is that if you take the basic metrics by which we measure how good fusion devices are, focused fusion is right in the midst of the huge government-backed program, even though it has thousands of times less resources. So to give an example of this, the key metric in fusion is really net energy. In other words, the ratio of energy out to the total energy into the device. And we've done comparisons that involve the net energy using a given fuel. So we're comparing apples with apples rather than apples with oranges, which would be different fuel. And that efficiency, the technical term for it is called wall plug efficiency. In other words, you plug this thing into the wall, you get the electricity out into the device, and how much energy do you get out? Well, right now, of all the devices in the world, our device, Focus Fusion 1, is number 2. And it's only a factor of 2 behind JET, the Joint European Tokamak, which billions of dollars invested in. And it's right now we're a factor of roughly almost 100 in that measure above the National Ignition Facility, which is, again, a $1 billion laser device. So in terms of results, we actually have shown results that are comparable to, and a separate jet are better than, these much larger devices. Now, the question is why? We don't think it's because we're clever. It's because we're taking a much easier path. The basic problem of the direction of the government-funded research, there's two basic problems. One is, 40 years ago, they decided to put all their eggs in one basket, which was the tokamak. That was a very misguided decision on many grounds. No one knew which device would work best. It obviously, the only correct decision was to spread the money among all the devices that could possibly work. So that was an administrative error. The technical error, in my opinion, is that almost all of these devices, not all of them, but almost all of them, attempt to maintain the plasma in a stable state. The way we say it is to make it behave like a good dog. Plasma isn't a good dog. Plasma, by its nature, is unstable. And the much easier approach, and that's the approach that we use in the Focus Fusion device, is to exploit the instabilities and to essentially encourage the instabilities that concentrate the energy and the power. So instead of fighting what the plasma does, we essentially guide the plasma in the direction that it wants to go. So that's why I think that that connects directly with the cost of these experiments. If you want a stable platform, for many reasons, the scaling is the bigger the machine, the better. And that's what has led to this gargantuanism in which the machine they're building in France, the ITER machine, is many, many stories high, hundreds of thousands of tons. It's a huge machine. Our machine sits in a room that's a few meters on the side, and the electrodes are basically a few centimeters across. So because we're not trying to stabilize the plasma, we're trying to use the instabilities, we can get a much smaller machine. And, of course, anything that's much smaller tends to be much cheaper. So that's why we think we can make much greater amounts of progress with our approach, because it's easier.
But obviously, the selling and reselling of the stabilization approach is working, because the governments don't seem to have any desire to pull back from this approach and to do something different. They just keep feeding it year after year after year.
Well, I think that that gets into the question of how we fund it. Now, not because, I mean, we think that the government should be funding not only us, but all of the other fusion approaches that have any physical chance of working. And we've said this publicly, and we've told the government that. In the meantime, we've been funding this through investment. And right now, we've been limited, up to now, we've been limited to soliciting investment in the United States from people who are what's called accredited investors, which is basically people who have quite a bit of money, because under American law, to be an accredited investor, you need $1 million in assets or $200,000 in personal annual income. But fortunately, that law changed, and it, in a limited way, for limited numbers of people and for a limited amount of money, to be precise, $1 million, we will be able to raise money from average people living in the United States. Now, we already can raise that money from people living outside the United States because they don't have similar laws. So I can't say that we're going to do this immediately, because the law actually says you can't say that until you're actually doing it. But I can say that we're looking to do this in the next really period of a very few months, possibly even weeks. So people will actually be able, for a limited time, to help us get the funding we need, no matter who they are. And that will be very important for us, because if we can raise $1 million, we intend to, at a minimum, hire one more person for the lab. And that's going to be very important with our tiny staff of 4 full-time people to increase our rate of progress. Now, that doesn't eliminate our looking for government funding. We do feel that if we can successfully complete the scientific phase of the research and prove that we alone have been able to reach net energy in the lab, then I'm pretty optimistic that some government, maybe not the U.S. federal government, will change their mind and fund us that $50 or $100 million. Because although $50 or $100 million is a lot more than we've spent, which is $5 million, there are very few governments in the world to which $50 or $100 million is a great deal of money. Obviously, to the U.S. government, it's less than they pay for a single aircraft. And, you know, It's something the state of New Jersey could afford. It's something the government of, you know, Singapore could afford. It's something that a lot of governments could afford. So I am optimistic that if we can prove net energy, then we won't have to raise this $100 million privately, or at least not all of it.
I have one more email, and I'll do this, and then we'll take our break. So this is from Joan, and Joan is in the Chicago area and says, I'm also at work, David, using email. My question is an economic one, I think. We constantly hear of these companies that want to go to the moon, and they constantly talk about helium-3 as a source of energy, even bringing it back and mining it to bring it back. They hardly ever mention that we need fusion in order to use it. But assuming that there was fusion, is it, in your opinion, economical to think of helium-3 as a main fusion-generating fuel, or is this just a bogus or misguided effort in terms of mining helium-3 on the moon for U.S. electrical power or Earth power using fusion?
Well, I don't think it's at all necessary. Before I get into that, I just want to add one thing to my previous answer, which is if people are interested in keeping up with our project, both, you know, its financing and its technical progress, we're very open and we put everything on our website. So I wanted to give people the website is LPPfusion.com. So that's LPPfusion.com. And you'll find us pretty readily on the web. So in terms of HE3, well, we don't need it. The ideal fuel and the fuel that we're intending to use with focused fusion and which we hope to be experimenting with within the next year to year and a half, is a combination of hydrogen and boron 11. Now, hydrogen is hydrogen. It's available from water, so it's very abundant. Boron 11 is the dominant natural isotope of boron. So about 80% of boron is boron 11. And boron is a relatively common material. To give you an idea, if we powered all of the existing needs, energy needs of the world from hydrogen-boron fusion, we would only have to use 10% of the current production of boron. If we expand energy production, we start digging out the mine, there's a second almost unlimited source of boron, which is in the ocean. And when you desalinate water, you actually have to remove boron from it because although boron is a nutrient, too much boron is a poison for agriculture, for plants. You have to take the boron out. And if you do that, you have essentially billions of years worth of fuel. So with hydrogen boron fuel, there would simply be no necessity for going with helium-3, which, as people point out, is not highly available. So, yes, I'd agree that going to the moon to mine helium-3 is a bit of a boondoggle.
That's always what I've heard from most people, but it still, as you know, is actively promoted, so... I thank Joan for her question. Listeners, we're a little beyond the halfway point, so we're going to take a couple of minutes of a break with Eric. We welcome your phone calls. We do answer the phone during the break. 1-866-687-7223. Email remains drspace@thespaceshow.com. And we'll be back in a couple of minutes. Don't go anywhere.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. Part two of our Space Show today, Monday, with Eric Lerner. A couple of sponsor messages. Integrated Space Analytics, which is part of the Space Finance Group, has the detailed 100-year projection called the Integrated Space Plan, and the guys behind it are coming on the Space Show and again in a few days. So the Integrated Space Plan includes space transportation, lunar bases, Mars, asteroids, space settlements, and everything we need. And their website, thespaceplan.com, it's being amended and updated and changed. That's what we'll soon be talking about on the Space Show. So go check it out. And we'll be talking Integrated Space Plan in just a few days again. AIAA is the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, and they are a sponsor. They're the world's largest aerospace professional society. They have five forums or main conference events during the year, including propulsion. And we urge you to check out their website and go and participate in these events, which are great for networking as well as content. AIAA.org. And then Celestis, the premier memorial spaceflight service, is a sponsor. And they have the new DNA service. So for people that have passed away, if you're doing traditional funerals, you can still send part of your loved one's DNA into space. And you can also send your own DNA with them. You can do suborbital as well as orbital flights. The DNA is in partnership with CG Labs of Canada. They're the world's leader in DNA collection. So there's a lot more to say about this. If you're interested, check them out at Celestis, CELESTIS.com. And Eric Lerner is back with us. And Eric, I have another email question for you from Tim. And Tim is in Huntsville. And he said if there was an ideal or perfect radiator for a spacecraft, what is the maximum pulse rate for the focused fusion type rocket? You stated 200 hertz for a terrestrial power plant. Could it be higher for spacecraft if the radiator problem was solved? Number two, do you have any updates on the research into plasma cosmology and eternal universe and criticism of the Big Bang theory?
Well, the first question is a lot shorter than the second. Let me just say that the basic answer is that we can pulse a lot quicker if we use multiple electrodes. So the circuit that is feeding these electrodes is relatively heavy, and that's what you obviously are concerned about when you're going into space is mass. So this circuit consists of capacitors and the circuitry associated. Now, these capacitors can fire quite quickly. That's what gives us our microsecond pulse. So these capacitors could probably fire on a cycle that might be, if we could solve all the cooling problems, might be something of the order of 100,000 times a second. So what you would probably do is put this one circuit together with hundreds of pairs of electrodes. Because the electrodes, there are clear physical limits on how rapidly you cool the electrodes, which are quite small. So you'd probably put hundreds of these electrodes in an array and feed them from a single capacitor circuit. So the answer is yes, we could get up, you know, many orders of magnitude, perhaps a factor of 500. So a single generator would then be generating, of the order of gigawatts of power. And you would need gigawatts of power for substantial thrust. So that would be basically the direction we would be taking. So in terms of plasma cosmology, wow, that's a big topic. Let me just say that I think that there's a steady drumbeat of observations that are incompatible with what people call the concordant cosmology, which is the idea of a hot big bang with inflation and dark matter and dark energy and all these other fairy dust factors. To give just one example, one of the leading supports for the Big Bang theory is supposedly that there is no other way than the Big Bang to get the abundance of certain light elements, which would include lithium, deuterium, and helium. And long before I got involved in the field, back in the 60s, people started pointing out, well, actually, stars can produce these very elements. Our star, our sun, is producing helium at a pretty good pace right now. And lithium can be produced, for example, by the cosmic rays from stars bunking into somewhat heavier material, somewhat heavier nuclei. Now, if the Big Bang produced these materials, and you expect that there's a certain minimum predicted by Big Bang theory that you're going to find in stars. If stars in our galaxy produce this material, then you would expect the older the star, the less of this material there would be. Well, there's been accumulating evidence, and this has been really over a period of years, that there is both what people call a lithium problem and a helium problem. And the lithium problem is that as we look at stars that are older and older, and we know that they're older and older because they have less and less of the really heavy elements like iron that are only produced by supernovas, these stars have less and less lithium, way below the limit that were predicted by the Big Bang. And the helium problem is exactly the same. If we look at stars that are older and older, and these are stars that are right in our local neighborhood, these are some of the stars that are closest to us, because they're the easiest to study, we find that the older stars have helium that's less, including much less, than the 24% predicted by the Big Bang. Now, in most fields of study, these contradictions by themselves would be enough to get the theory rejected. But unfortunately, there's a rather bad sociology in cosmology, which is that the funding is highly concentrated. It's controlled by people who spent their lives defending the Big Bang. And therefore, you get a herd mentality in which it's very, very difficult for people to say this result contradicts the Big Bang theory. So if you look at these papers where people publish these results, they say, well, there must be something wrong with our understanding of stellar evolution, with our understanding of these observations, or something. We just haven't figured it out. Because, of course, they contradict the Big Bang, so it means the observations are wrong. And that's not the way science should function. Especially when, in this case, there's an alternative theory that predicts very clearly exactly the results that have been obtained.
But it's not going mainstream anytime soon, is it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a real, really big problem. I mean, you know, in fusion you have some of this problem in that the funding decisions are still made on the basis of a orthodoxy, that Tokamaks are orthodoxy, everything else is unorthodox. But if you look at publication, and if you look at the way people talk at conferences, which I've attended a lot, the average scientist in the field says, hey, this is not going right. We really need other better ideas than the Tokamak. This program is not, you know, there's a lot of interest in alternative ideas. And, for example, back in 2012, when we first published record high temperatures in our device, that paper was published in one of the leading journals in our field, Physics of Plasmas. And according to Physics of Plasmas, it was the most read, most downloaded paper for that year. So in fusion, you really, although you haven't broken through the orthodoxy in funding, you really have an open discussion among scientists. In cosmology, you're just not there, and I'm not quite sure how you're going to get there. Because people really fear for their careers if they say, look, there's doubt whether the universe is expanding, there's doubt whether the universe went through a hot Big Bang phase. People have told us that they think saying this publicly is putting them at risk of never getting a fusion cosmology grant again in their lives. So, and there's, it's not just funding pressure. There's a lot of social pressure in that, in cosmology, the theorists outnumber the observational scientists by a very large margin, perhaps 10 to 1. That's almost not true in any other field of science. Generally, it's like the theorists are the carnivores and the, experimenters are the herbivores, and it takes a lot of experimenters to support one theoretician. But in cosmology, it's really quite different. Observations are extremely expensive. They take, you know, devices that cost billions of dollars to build and put up into space. Theory is very cheap. All you need is a computer. And I think the fact that the theoreticians have, you know, a vested interest in this theory, there's a social intimidation of observationalists who come up with contradictions. So I don't know exactly the solution to that. It's taken a lot longer to get an open discussion than I would have thought. Some of my colleagues have said, well, Once we solve the fusion problem, maybe that's going to open people up to plasma applications in cosmology. I'm not sure whether that will work, but maybe that's what it will take.
my problem with all of this is I do put scientists and people on the show that have alternative ideas. And then a mainstream guy will come on and say such and such is a phony, you know, bogus person and it's crap science or pseudoscience or whatever. But I give a lot of people that I can determine are not crackpots airtime for alternative theories. The dilemma I have is there are many, many more alternative theories out there that to me smell like crackpot stuff that I don't want to give airtime to. So the ability to discern the difference between plausible fringe and crackpot fringe is pretty hard to do sometimes.
Well, I think that there is. I mean, first of all, as I said, cosmology has developed a sort of pathology because the dominant cosmology basically says you can, their methodology is you can invent a theory, invent new forces of nature with, you know, a pen and a pencil or a computer and a laptop and a keyboard. And that's how you do science. It doesn't start from the observation. So, I mean, I receive in the mail, right now, I would say once or twice a month, a new theory of the universe.
Yeah, I get those.
And, you know, when my book was new, Big Bang Never Happened, there were weeks when I received one of these theories every day. And the basic thing is, what distinguishes a theory that's at least worth looking at is two things. One is, the theory has to be reduced to quantitative prediction. And two is, because I have a lot of people who send me, you know, essays, and they say, well, I have trouble with the mathematics. Can you help me reduce this to mathematical form? Well, math is the language of physics, the language of all the quantitative sciences. A theory has to be reduced to a mathematical form. But that's only half of what distinguishes a real theory from, something that's bogus. The other half is you have to compare it with a set of observations. And you have to show this is a better fit than existing theory. Now, I don't say that you have to compare it with every set that's available. And that's what, sort of what the Big Bang cosmologists set up. They say, well, look, we have microwave sets of data, we have light elements, we have supernova brightnesses. Your theory has to fit all of these. Well, that takes resources, it takes money. So I don't think that's a good test. But I think that you have to take at least one of those tests, preferably more than one, and you have to show your theory reduced to mathematical form provides a good fit for those tests. Now, when people do that, which is, I would say, 1 out of 100 of these theories of the universe, then I think they have to be considered this is science. Whether it's good science or bad science, you have to look at it to tell. But it's certainly scientific. That's what the scientific method is comparing theory with observation, comparing hypothesis with something that can test the hypothesis. So that's the criterion I would use. If somebody comes out and says, look, I've got this great theory, here's a verbal description of it, I don't really have the math worked out, and I would say, you know, that's fine, come back to me when you have the math worked out. Or if somebody says, I have a beautiful mathematical theory, but I haven't really compared it with observation, I would say, well, come back when you have done that. If somebody says, I've got a theory, here are the observations that it fits, then I would say, well, will consider having you on the show if I was running the show. I mean, how does that sound as criterion? Would that be helpful?
That would eliminate about 99.9% of the,
right.
Of the people. I've got another follow-up question from Tim, and he says, I forgot to ask you, what is the difference between plasma cosmology and the electric universe theory?
Well, I would say that I've looked at, you know, these websites that deal with electric universe, and I'm a little unclear about what that is involved there. I mean, I would classify it as a theory that seems to have very little clear-cut quantitative comparison between prediction and observation. I mean, there's a lot of description, but it isn't really reduced to what I can see is something that can be compared directly with theory. To the extent, so I guess that's what I would say. I mean, plasma cosmology, I'm not sure whether I coined that term or other people did. I'll have to look back in history to find that out. But if we're talking about the study of cosmology that essentially extends from the work of Hannes Alfvén and his colleagues, what that is about is simply applying plasma physics as we learn about it in the places where we can directly observe plasma, which is in the laboratory and within the solar system, where we can and have placed laboratory instruments in the plasma in the solar system. And we use what we learn to understand the universe at the largest scale, knowing that plasma phenomena are extremely important throughout the universe, and that the universe that we observe, it consists overwhelmingly of plasma. So that's basically the approach that I would say is plasma cosmology. And certainly I think that what we do is scientific in the sense that we try and use well-founded theories to produce quantitative comparison with observation. And, you know, so far, and I'd be happy if people point out where I'm wrong, but so far, at least what I've seen of the electric universe, that quantitative comparison was left out. I mean, I'd sort of put that back on you. Have you seen much that is quantitative?
I haven't done very many programmings specific to plasma cosmology, but...
To this electric universe.
Okay, so yeah. I don't want to spend a lot of time on electric universe, but I got hit last year with lots and lots of listeners wanting an electric universe show. And they sent me to two guys in Australia. One of them was too busy and the other one did the show. Very, very nice guy. And I came away thinking this is the biggest bunch of crap that I, and I'm not a scientist, remember, my background is business and economics. That, so number one, they don't believe you need to know any math, okay? And it's real popular because people say, finally, I understand the solar system and the universe. Well, that's because they don't need to know anything about science or math to understand what these guys say. It's all based on electromagnetism, which they have a simple way of explaining. All of the particles of atoms and nucleus and molecules don't matter for anything. They just dismiss them. They're useless, frivolous. You don't have to worry about it all. And all you need to know is that everything works through electromagnetism, and therefore that's the electric universe. And
I do think that I think that scientific theories can be explained very well without heavy use of equations and mathematics. But when it comes to comparing observation theory with observation, which is a key test of whether the theory is true, you must use mathematics because you have to have quantitative comparison. And mathematics is simply a language. There's nothing mystical about it. It's simply a language, just like English or musical notation, that you use to describe things quantitatively. And if you don't make that, you know, connection in which you're making quantitative predictions and comparing them with quantitative observations, then you're not really doing science. And you're not testing whether your theories are true or just, you know, fantasy. This is also key to how the physical sciences have become the basis of technology. I mean, as I love to point out, you know, the demonstration of the truth of aerodynamics is proven every time that airplane that you're on takes off. You know that there's truth in aerodynamics by the fact that you're not worried about the airplane dropping from the sky suddenly. But that's a very rare occurrence caused by specific mechanical failure. So you need a highly quantitative science to be able to design an airplane that stays up in the sky. And there's a very good book out there, the recent biography of the Wright brothers, which actually shows that they weren't at all tinkerers, that they actually were scientists, even though they weren't academically trained, whose discoveries in wind tunnels about, you know, aerodynamics led them to the control mechanism that allowed them to have an airplane that could actually stay in the sky. So mathematics is critical to testing whether a theory is true or not.
Do you, going back to your fusion work, what do you see for 2017? What would be your goals for your work for 2017? What would make it a really good year for you?
Well, clearly what we want to do is go on to our next stage, which is using beryllium. We want to demonstrate that getting rid of the impurities causes a big jump in fusion yield, and we hope by the end of the year to actually start experiments with our final fuel, which is hydrogen and boron. So if we accomplish all that, that will be very good. In addition, to keep us going, we very much want to raise at least $1 million, maybe $1.5 million, hopefully partially through the equity crowdfunding. And as I say, we hope people will keep track of us through lppfusion.com.
Do you think you're on track for accomplishing these goals? We're coming into the third month of the year.
Very much, yes. I would say that we still have an excellent chance of accomplishing those goals, of at least starting the hydrogen-boron, the final phase of our experiment, by December.
Well, we'll certainly look forward to it. I have not yet talked to a company that has done an equity crowdfunding deal. I'm waiting to do that and to see how it works and all that. Maybe you'll be the first one.
Well, we hope so. As I say, we can't make any definite promises until we actually start it. But once we start it, then people will see it. We'll direct them to the crowdfunding website from our website.
Well, I'll look forward to hearing about that, I hope you'll be really successful at it. Well, we'll stay in touch with you and continue to follow your work. Do you have another book coming out or anything like that?
No, there's this project is pretty much consuming me full time. We hope to have more publications in the scientific literature soon. So.
Okay. We will we will stay in touch. Thank you very much, okay?
Okay, and thank you.
Thank you. And listeners, that's it for today with Eric, and come back for tomorrow with our Tuesday evening space show. Check us out on our website newsletter or the email newsletter. And again, thanks to Eric for being with us again, and to those of you who emailed us. We appreciate it. Everyone have a great week, and thanks again for listening to the space show. Goodbye from Eric and David.